Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
Saints, verse 18, the saints of the Holy One received the kingdom. Verse 22, Ancient of Days, judgment wasn't passed in favor of the saints of the Most High. They took possession of the kingdom. Verse 27, saints. Now, the ideal is that the saints took the kingdom, while verse 13 says the Son of Man took the kingdom. What's the relationship? Okay, think with me. The beast represents a king as well as a kingdom, don't they? Nebuchadnezzar as well as the kingdom of Babylon, right? The little horn represents one king as well as a kingdom. So too here. Beautiful picture of the relationship between the Son of God and the children of God. The kingdom is Jesus, but the kingdom is given to us. For you see, we and Jesus Christ are brothers. The saints of God will inherit all that Jesus Christ inherits. We are co-heirs, the New Testament says. Therefore, you see what it's doing? It's saying the saints are going to have the kingdom, plural, but it says the Son of Man is going to have the kingdom. I think it's talking about the same thing. The kingdom, and then over there in 27 it says, His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all His dominion will serve and obey Him. Singular, pronoun referring to a person. The kingdom belongs to Jesus Christ, but it is given to us as co-heirs. Now, you notice down there where it says, verse 18, the saints will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. Why can't that be a reference to the millennial kingdom? It's never going to end. This kingdom is forever. The millennial kingdom is a limited kingdom, isn't it? It's a time-locked kingdom. Okay, can't be the millennium. Now, notice about waging war with the saints, overpowering them. Isn't it funny in verse 21 that God allows the forces of evil to subjugate His people? This book is written in a time of persecution. The whole setting, so is Revelation. Now, notice in verse 24, it will devour the whole earth, the fourth beast. I think we better back up on that. I think you better see F 4:1 where it says Nebuchadnezzar ruled the whole earth. Nebuchadnezzar did not rule the whole earth, did he? He didn't rule the Mayas and the Incas. He didn't rule the Slavic German tribes. He didn't rule China or Asia or the Polynesian kingdoms. He didn't rule the whole earth. But it's a way of expressing a great kingdom. I think the fourth kingdom here is not so much a worldwide kingdom, a clearing around the world, as it is a very extensive kind of power. So I think we need to talk about that. Now, notice in verse 25, and will make alterations in times and in law. They go back to this idea of being Antiochus Epiphanes, changing the Jewish laws. But I want you to notice that says make alterations in times and in law. That does not necessarily refer to religious law, does it? Or religious times. It refers to time in general as far as dates and remembering dates and law in general, not necessarily religious law. Now, very important. See this little phrase, time, time, and a half a time? Boy, this is where the fight goes. What does that thing mean? My translation, those little stinkers, put in the side, i.e. year. They're saying, this thing means a year. How many of your translations do that in a footnote? Okay. Scofield does it. Who else? New American Standard does it. Does anybody else have something? Does Living Bible make it a year? A year? A year and a half year? 3.5 years? That is completely interpreted. Completely. This little word doesn't always mean year because they are what? They're not. They don't have the same solar year we have. They're on a lunar calendar. But I want to show you something very interesting. Turn on the back of your paper, please. Right underneath number symbolism. And put the date related to the second coming. Date related to the second coming. If this is a year, and it's talking about a year and a half a year, or 3.5 years, that is 1,277 days, right? 1,277, put that down. Daniel 7:25, 1,277 days. Daniel 8:14 is going to list a number of evenings and mornings. If you divide them by two, you get 1,150 days. Daniel 11:2 and 13:5
is going to use a thing called 42 months. 42 months is about 1,260 days. Daniel 12:11 has a little thing that says 1,290 days. And then Daniel 12:12 has 1,335 days. I made one mistake, and I'm sorry. When I told you Daniel 11:2 and Daniel 13:5, that should be Revelation. Revelation 11:2 and Revelation 13:5 has 42 months. Now, that's not exactly the number of days, is it? But you catch how close all those different numbers are? They're within 100, less than 100 of each other. Now, what we've got here is not the thing that we can pick dates like October 14th and January 2nd, but we have almost a unanimous kind of vote on how long this times, the times and a half times is. Now, I think it's interpreted to make this a year, but I think with all these other references that it's a very good choice to make it a year. You see what I'm saying? Because it's so close, 1290, 1260, 1277, 1335, real close, very close. Now, exactly what that means, we'll get into another chapter because it's almost time for me to go home. Now, notice in verse 27 where it says, the word, and all dominions will serve him. You see that at the very last of verse 27? This can't refer to the kingdom being the Jewish nation. Some people say that when it says the saints of the Most High will get the kingdom, dispensationalism now says this refers to the Jewish people only and not the church. Well, I don't buy that. So number one, the word serve in verse 27 is we have 9 examples of this word being used in Aramaic. Every one of the 9 uses of this word, it's used in reference to deity. When it says serve and obey him, it's not talking about saints. It's talking about this Ancient of Days and especially the representative, the Son of Man, Jesus, the mediator, okay? The Messiah, if you would. Now, I think that the saints of the Most High or the Holy One is referring to the church, Old Testament, New Testament. I think it's talking about all the people of God. You see, I see God having a plan not for Israel, but I see God having a plan for the redemption of mankind. And everybody who trusts God by faith, Jew or Greek, is in that vast horde of people called the saints of the Most High, Revelation 5. Okay. I think that's it. Golly dog, what a chapter. Got any questions? I think I've hit you with way too much, but I hope you got some of it that'll relate to chapter 8. I told you it's going to be a boogaboo. You just don't hit this without getting into ambiguous passages, different interpretations. But you see, by going into the why of the interpretations, I think we get a clearer picture of biblical presuppositions, don't we? That what you think before you read the text determine sometimes what that text says. You see what I'm saying? Any questions or comments tonight about Daniel and the beast and all? Okay, please read chapter 8 and 9 for next week. I'll just cover 8. But you need to read 8 and 9. Please sit down when you get home or whenever you get a chance to study your Bible. And I want you to outline the kingdoms in chapter 7. Put lion, wings, heart of a man. Okay. Then that's Nebuchadnezzar. Then put leopard, 4 wings, moves fast, all that. And then do the same thing for chapter 8 on those 4 kingdoms. Now, if you'll do this, Daniel will mean something to you. There's an image in chapter 2 that has 4 kingdoms. Write those out. Gold, silver, bronze, iron, and clay. Chapter 2. Chapter 7, 4 kingdoms. What are they? They're the lion, they're the bear, they're the leopard, indescribable animal, okay? Chapter 8, you're going to have 4 more kingdoms. See if they're going to parallel, okay? Now, I'll give you a hint. They're not going to parallel. But if you don't do that, you're going to get so confused the time we get through of 8, you're going to say, horns, wheels, wings, teeth. I'll wait to get through Daniel and come back on Wednesday night. So, going to take me. I told you, you couldn't study Daniel and Revelation without working at it. outline these chapters for next week, okay?
We hope you enjoyed today's verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study. If you would like a free outline of today's lesson, please write us at Bible Lesson, Box 1289, Marshall, Texas, 75671. Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
I'll be in Daniel chapter 8 today. It's very important as we look at Daniel that we realize, number one, God gave us these for a purpose. Now, there's two focus in God give us Scripture. Number one, He gave it to the people of the day in which it was written. And that's what chapter 8 is certainly for. The Jewish people in the post-exilic period who are going to experience some terrible persecution under a Seleucid leader called Antiochus Epiphanes around 168 to 165 B.C. Now, chapter 7 is given more of an end-time orientation, which is more for that generation following that to help us see the persecution that's going to come right before the end of the age, the birth pains of the Messianic age. Now, it's very important that we see that there is a set relationship in the flow of Daniel. Chapter 2 describes an image with a five-fold successive empires. There's the head of gold, which is Nebuchadnezzar. And then becomes the silver breast, which obviously is Medo-Persia. And then it becomes the leg of bronze, which seems to be Greece, Alexander the Great. And then the feet of iron and clay, which seems to be the Roman Empire, which will be destroyed by supernatural means and an eternal kingdom set up, which is the heaven or eternity with God. Now, chapter 7 parallels that. It's the lion with wings, it's the bear, it's the leopard with wings, and it's the beast that's so bad it's undescript. And then finally, at the end, we have this beautiful picture of the Son of Man receiving the kingdom. Now, chapter 8 focuses in on two aspects of those five kingdoms. It's going to focus in on the second and third. So it's going to focus in on Persia and Greece. Now, this section is primarily for the Jewish people. Now, I want to say a word to you about why it seems so unusual to us to have prophecy like this. First of all, the Old Testament only saw one coming of the Messiah. But we know from the New Testament that Jesus came twice, incarnated at Bethlehem, but coming again on the clouds of heaven as the King of Kings. He came first as Savior, He's coming as Judge. Well, that time gap is shortened in its Old Testament perspective. Now, I think we see this clearly in 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, where it talks about, there are many antichrists in the world, but there is a coming, capital A, Antichrist. There's been much confusion about the Antichrist, the little horn mentioned in chapter 7 and the little horn mentioned in chapter 8. I believe it's the Antichrist with a capital A in chapter 7 and one of the Antichrists with a little a in chapter 8. Now, the reason I think that is, I think there's always been this spirit against God. And Antiochus Epiphanes characterizes that spirit in the particular period of the Persian Empire. There have always been those kind of people, those kind of movements. It is going to be ultimately personified in the man of sin, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. So I think the little horn of chapter 7 is the Antichrist, and the little horn of chapter 8 is a Antichrist. Now, remember that the little horn of 7 comes in the fourth kingdom, but the little horn of 8 comes in the third kingdom, if my designations are right. Now, we are told in chapter 8, verse 20 and 21, that the vision refers to Medo-Persia and Greece. It seems to fit the flow of 2, 7, and 8 that those kingdoms fit together like that. So I hope you'll follow with me as we go through chapter 8. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, so we're 2 years after the vision of chapter 7, okay? A vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. Now, in the Hebrew here, Daniel's just surprised that he got another vision. He wasn't expecting the first one of chapter 7. Now, he had interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's and other people's,
But he was greatly honored that God would give him the vision of seven, and he was greatly honored, though it made him sick both times, to have the vision of chapter 8. Notice where it says, "And I looked in a vision, it came about while I was looking that I was in the citadel of Susa." Now, this is very similar to Ezekiel chapter 8, where the prophet is caught up from Babylon by the river Kibar and transported to Jerusalem to see a vision. I do not believe Daniel was in Shushan or Susa, both go by the same name. It's the later summer capital of the coming kingdom of Medo-Persia. At this time, it was just a large city. It was not a capital of anything. It was not even in one of the major provinces of Babylon. And yet, that's where Daniel finds himself. He recognizes it. How? From pictures? We don't know. He's in the citadel or the castle or the stronghold of Susa, Shushan. Now, he realized he's by a river here. Notice it says, which is the province of Elam. He needed to tell people where it was in his day because they didn't know about this city. It wasn't famous yet. And I looked in the vision. I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. Now, we know there's two different rivers this is called. We think this was the unity of the branch of two different rivers. We know from history it was 900 feet wide, a very large irrigation canal. Okay? Now, "And I lifted up my gaze, and looked, behold, a ram with two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now, the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, and the longer one came up last." Well, obvious a vision, because the horns, he's going to see them come out. Now, this seems to fit, and it's definitely told in verse 20. This is the Medo-Persian Empire. We know that the empire of Media came first and was more powerful, but that Persia, Cyrus, was more aggressive, and Persia became the dominant force. That's why we call the empire Persia. And so it fits history completely about these two aspects. It's the bear of chapter 7 with one side lifted up. Now, notice where it says, verse 4. "And I saw a ram budding westward, northward, and southward." Now, this ram, of course, describes the directions that the Persian Empire invaded. Isn't it unusual that the east is not mentioned? We know from history that there was significant territorial gains in these different areas, particularly the south being Egypt, the north being Lydia, and the west, I've forgotten what the west is. Let me look back and see if I can find it a second. I mentioned it in the last chapter. Yeah, the west would be Babylon. Now, we know from history that there was no significant gains to the east until the later reign of Darius the First Hastrapes, that would be 521 to 485 B.C. And so it fits perfectly into the history that we know. Now, notice where it mentions here, some think this refers to the three ribs that the bear had in his mouth, the three directions of the compass, back in chapter 7, verse 5. "While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west." Now, this, we learn from chapter 21, is Greece. And the conspicuous horn is going to be Alexander the Great. It fits geographically. Notice it's coming from the west. And that's exactly the way the Grecian Empire would come to the kingdom of Persia. "Over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground." This is the emphasis of speed that we have back in chapter 7, verse 6, with the leopard with four wings. Alexander conquered so swiftly the whole known world. "And the goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes." This is Alexander the Third, that we commonly call Alexander the Great, the son of Philip of Macedon. "And he came up to the ram that had two horns, which was standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him with a mighty wrath." Notice verse 7. "He was enraged at him." Now, we know from history that the Greeks were so angry with the Persians. Under Darius the Third, Greece tried to cross the Hellespont three or four different times and invade Greece and were repulsed. It made the Greeks so mad that Persia was trying to dominate them. When Alexander finally crossed the Hellespont, and I think it's in 334 B.C., with 34,000 troops, I think it's about 30,000 men and 5,000 cavalry, And he faced the Persian army. Now, the numbers may be slightly exaggerated, but it says in history 600,000 men. Alexander was such a military genius. His army was so well structured and planned that he routed this huge army three different times. When Darius tried to make a pact with him, Alexander said, "No way." Alexander was so angry that he destroyed Persia and would not compromise at all. Now, notice what it says, "And so he hurled him to the ground and trampled him," and Persia is eliminated from the scene of history. "And there was none to rescue the ram from his," Alexander's, "power. And the male goat magnified himself exceedingly." Now, because of the context of Daniel 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, this is not like the exceeding boastful braggadociousness of the little horns. This Hebrew idiom seems to mean he was very successful and his domain was very large. It doesn't mean he bragged that he was deity or flaunted himself against the God of Israel. That's not what this Hebrew idiom means here, although it does mean that in connection with a little horn that's going to come up later. Okay? But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and its place came up four conspicuous horns towards the four winds of heaven. Now, here we have another strikingly detailed predictive prophecy. There are some who try to identify the little horn of chapter 7 and the little horn of chapter 8 because they believe it's too detailed of history and it must have been written down the Maccabean period to be so accurate. Others try to identify them because of their eschatological systems, particularly dispensational premillennialists, starting with Lindsay. Now, I think what we have here, in history we know that Alexander the Great was sad because the whole world was conquered. And apparently he died of a fever, a swamp fever, because he had lived such a, not only a fast-paced life, but apparently had some abuse of alcohol and was just a push kind of fella, and he died of the fever at 32 years old. Well, there are five Greek generals that in the period of 20 years fought over Alexander's empire. Four of them became dominant. Let me give them to you if I could. Ptolemy in Egypt, Cassander in Greece, Seleucus in Syria and Babylon, Lysimachus in Thrace. Now, there is an Antiochus the Fourth, and I think it's Antigonus, which was part of Asia Minor, but lost the battle and was removed from power. So basically four, and this fits so well, this predictive prophecy about the four horns. "And out of one of them came a rather small horn that grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land, the promised land." This seems to fit the eighth Seleucid ruler known as Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Through cunning trickery, which is going to be depicted here in the text, he widened his empire into Egypt, into Babylon, and controlled the promised land. Now, the reason I think that he is particularly picked out as just one of the Seleucid rulers is because of the miseries that he caused the Jews. And we've switched to history in chapter 8. 2 through 7 describe the world empires and the consummation of God's sovereignty over history in the end time. But now, beginning in chapter 8, God's trying to prepare the Jewish people for a persecution that's going to occur before the Messiah comes, and we're switching back to Hebrew for them, and I think that's why we're focusing in on this particular ruler. Notice where it says in verse 10, "And he grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to earth, and it trampled them down." Now, this stars of heaven seems to be a way of talking about the people of God. We see it from Genesis 15:5, from Jeremiah 33:22, and from Daniel 12:3. And so what we have here is this man's success against the people of God. Now, notice, if you would, where it mentions here, "And he even magnified himself to be equal with the commander of the host." Now, this is a very similar phrase to Lord Sabaoth, which is a characteristic name of God in the post-exilic books. I think here it's referring to God, okay? Not only the captain of the host, meaning the saints, but the word is also used of the angelic realm, and so it's a title for God. Now, notice it says, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him, meaning God, and placed in the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. The idea is defiled. Now, this regular sacrifice, we know from verse 12, is the Hebrew word continually, which seems to refer to not only the sacrifice, but the regular offerings and incense burning and all of that of the temple. Now, we know this occurred in around 168 B.C., through where intrigue Antiochus got into Jerusalem. He stopped the regular Jewish feast days and the regular sacrifices. We even know that he set up an altar to Zeus in the place of the altar of incense in the holy place, and he offered a pig on the altar and forced Jews to eat this flesh of the pigs. Now, the reason for this is he wanted to Hellenize the Jews. He was following the footsteps of Alexander the Great, and he was going to force it on them, and that's how much of this problem with the Jews came. Now, if you're familiar with the histories of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, you'll know that this is where the priest of Modin rebelled, and his sons with him started a guerrilla warfare that finally cleansed the temple in 165, December of 165, which we know as the Feast of Lights or Purim, which is modern Hanukkah that the Jews have around our Christmas time. Now, the man we know is Judas Maccabeus, known as Judas the Hammer, and it started a whole system of intrigue that finally issues in Herod being on the throne in Jesus' day. Okay? Now, when it says here, on account of the transgression, now some have thought it means the Jewish sin, the rebellion, after the post-exilic period, allowed God to dominate them again by using Antiochus as his instrument of judgment, as he has previously used Assyria, Babylon, and Persia. But I really think, because of the Hebrew, it's referring to the sin of Antiochus Epiphanes. But we can't be sure. Notice it mentions the host again, which seems to be the people of God, over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling the truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. And this seems to refer to the period of domination of the Jewish people. Now, this period lasted about 6 or 7 years. It's very hard to go back in Maccabees and find certain dates that fit the exact dating of the book of Daniel. Okay, now, then I heard a holy one. Now, this seems to be an angel. One angel is asking another angel. This is usually the word saint, holy one, but it's got to be an angel here. Some think this relates to 1 Peter 1:12, where the angels longed to look into the plan of God. One angel understood, one angel didn't, one angel asked the other. But I'm not sure that fits really, because what we have here, the angels are speaking for the purpose of Daniel's hearing, not the curiosity of the angel. How long will this vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled? How long is it going to last, this domination by this Antiochus Epiphanes? Well, here is the answer in verse 14. And I wish it was a much more clear, but it's a little ambiguous. It's apocalyptic language. And he said to me, "For 2300 evening and mornings, and the holy place will be properly restored." Well, evening and morning seem to refer to the sacrificial system, the morning and evening sacrifices, or go back to Genesis where day begins in the evening and then goes to the morning. Now, the question is, Ben, is it 6 years, 110 days, or is it 3.5 years? Do you take each one as separately, or do you take them as one day? Boy, I'm in a pickle here. There are many other dates in Daniel 7 through 12 that seem to imply the 3.5 years. And because this can mean that, I'm attracted to it. Historically, in the Maccabean period, there is a 6 year and a third period of the domination of Antiochus Epiphanes over the Jews. Neither one of them really fits the historical facts of Maccabees as we understand them. So I must admit, I just do not know. I want to say the 7 years, but I'm pulled toward the 3.5 because of other numbers in this prophetic apocalyptic section of Daniel. Now, obviously this was restored in 165 A.D. I believe it's December 12th. And it came about that I, seeing these visions that I had sought, understood it. Behold, standing before me was one like a man. Now, obviously an angel. Angels appear as men. And this one's going to be named. I heard a voice of a man between the banks of the Euli, and he called out and said, "Gabriel, give this man understanding of the vision." Now, this seems to be the voice of God commanding Gabriel. There are only two angels named in the Bible, Gabriel and Michael. Both of them appear in Daniel. Gabriel appears in the Gospels. Daniel appears in Jude. Michael appears in Jude. Now, Daniel seems to mean man of God. He seems to be the messenger angel because he is mentioned in Luke 1:19 and Luke 1:26. He brings the message to Elizabeth. He brings the message to Mary. He is also mentioned in Daniel chapter 7, verse 27, later in the book. Verse 21. Now, Michael is also mentioned later as the guardian angel of Israel. Many think that Michael is the pre-incarnate Jesus. I'm not sure that's true. That is the period. Those are the only angels mentioned, and they both appear as a man. They're not cherubs. They're not seraphim. They seem to appear as a man. Some have called them archangels. We're not sure of that, except Michael is called an archangel. So he came near where I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. That's always what men do in the presence of the supernatural realm. John did that on the island of Patmos. Ezekiel did that in his vision of Jerusalem. It just scares the hound out of him. God's characteristic word to man when he breaks down his life is, fear not. And boy, I can understand that. But deliver me from angels popping in and out of my understanding. But he said to me, son of man. Now, isn't this unusual? Now, look at your verse 17. Mine has it capitalized. I don't know why it's capitalized. It's simply saying human being. The usage here is like the book of Ezekiel. This is not a title for the Messiah, like back in chapter 7, verse 13. It simply should be a little s. And it's not Ben Adam, it's Ben Enosh, which means frail man. Okay, understand the vision pertains to the end of the time of the end. Now, this doesn't mean it's what we would think as the end of the world. It refers to the end of the period of transgression of the Jewish people under Antiochus IV. Now, notice in verse 18 that Daniel sinks down and has to be woke up, and it's something. He just loses touch here physically. Then he said, "Behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur in the final period of the indignation." This means the wrath of God. This is used several times, this word indignation, throughout the Old Testament. You know, I've listed in your outline the several places it's used. Now, some think it refers to the exile. Some think it refers to Antiochus Epiphanes, and some think it refers to the great tribulation of the end time. Well, let me say to you again, knowing Old Testament prophecy, it could refer to any of those or all of those. Remember how the historical foreshadowing occurs? A contemporary event is used to describe a future event and ultimately an end time event. Well, that's so common that it could be either one of those. For it pertains to the appointed time of an end. This same phrase is used in Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 3 for the Babylonian destruction. So, whatever. The ram is Medo-Persia. Notice that in verse 20. Well, why use the ram? Well, it was the sign of the zodiac, Aries, that was used for the nation of Persia. We also know that the guardian spirit of Persia was a ram. We know that when they went out in battle, they had a ram on their shields. So it's an obvious symbol. The nations today have animal symbols. A bear for Russia, an eagle for the United States, a lion for England, and so on. So it's a common thing. Now, the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. That's verse 21. We note the sign of the zodiac was Capricorn for Greece. And we also know that on the Macedonian coat of arms was a sign of a shaggy male goat. And so it seems to fit history that these were the two symbols used. We have the same interpretation coming that I've already given you, and Daniel was being explained this by the angel. Obviously, God did not give this for such confusion. He gave it for the people of Israel to understand a future persecution that is going to be a historical foreshadowing of the ultimate persecution that we call the tribulation period that will happen to the people of God before the second coming of the Messiah. Now, I know all this is confusing, and we've got to kind of link this together, but be very careful when you do. Because sometimes we get more dogmatic over our systems than we do of the Bible. The Bible is ambiguous. The Bible is in apocalyptic literature. The Bible, I believe, does not have a systematic eschatology, though it does give us true glimpses of what will happen to prepare the people of God. It's amazing to me that every generation tries to fit all of these into their day. I think they're going to historically fit perfectly the last generation, and we need to quit being so selfish about making all the Bible apply to us. It had a meaning to its day. It has a meaning to us. It'll have a meaning to the end generation. Now, notice in verse 23, this Antiochus Epiphanes is described in greater detail as a very tricky kind of person. He's going to win his power by intrigue and subtlety and craftiness, and God's going to let him do it. And that's what's going to be amazing. And you see that both in 23 and 24. Now, if you want to see the history of this, you ought to get 1 Maccabees and read chapter 1, verses 29 through 41, chapter 1, verses 44 through 50, and chapter 4, verses 38 and 39. This describes some of this intrigue connected with the takeover of Jerusalem and some of his other conquests. First, the books of Maccabees have some excellent history of the interbiblical period and ought to be read not for inspired doctrine, but for the history of the day that prepares the scene for the ministry of Jesus in Galilee and Perea and Judea. Now, in verse 27, it wiped Daniel plumb out. It was just like chapter 7. I don't know about you. When I study some of these apocalyptic passages, I love the Bible so much. I want to take it so seriously. I'm a historical grammatical exegete, which means I want to take it literally. I want to see how it fits in history. I'm committed to its literalness. But I get sick at my stomach trying to fit all this together. And I can't do it. I want to know what God's saying, yet I have such great problems. I pray and study and compare and look up parallels and struggle with the context and try to get the etymology of words and look at the history of the day. And I must admit to you, the more I try to put Ezekiel, Daniel, Zechariah, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, the book of the Revelation together, I don't feel better. I feel worse. Because I think all the systems, including my own, tend to twist or force or ignore parts of the Word of God. Friends, I want to say to you, Jesus is coming back again, physically. This was given to us for a purpose, to know that God is sovereign. He's in control of history. He's shown us some things that are going to happen, so when the persecution falls on the church, and I believe the people of God will go through the tribulation, I'm post-trib. I believe they'll know that God's, and that's why God gave it to the Jews. They went through the tribulation of this Antiochus Epiphanes, so God would know. I mean, they would know that God's with them. I think He's done the same thing in some of this for the church. I wish I had a more clear answer, but to tell you the truth, the more I study, the more I feel uncomfortable with dogmatic eschatology of anybody's system. The Bible will throw a lot of light on commentaries if you left the Bible be the only guide for faith and practice. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.